From feature story news in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's programme, Israel rejects a ceasefire plan put forward by US Secretary of State John Kerry as the bloodshed in Gaza spreads to the West Bank.
The agony of the events on the ground in Gaza, the West Bank and Israel, all of them together, simply cannot be overstated.
Also today, EU ambassadors agree a preliminary deal on tougher sanctions for Russia. And the French president confirms that there were no survivors in the Air Algérie plane crash in Mali.
I share in the family's pain who are going through a terrible time. They will be received tomorrow in the French Foreign Ministry so that we can give them all the information.
That's coming up on FSN Reports after a summary of our latest news headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. The Israeli cabinet has rejected plans put forward for a ceasefire in Gaza. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry and top United Nations officials had been trying to broker a deal in Cairo. Nick Harper reports from the U.N. headquarters in New York.
The news that the U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry and the Secretary General of the United Nations Ban Ki-moon were due to hold a press conference on Friday sparked optimism that a peace agreement may be near. Reports were that this would be a two-part ceasefire plan, with a humanitarian truce starting on Sunday. That would allow for more negotiations to find a more permanent ceasefire agreement, but the rejection from Israel's Security Cabinet has put pay to that. And with Hamas insisting that Israel must end its blockade of Gaza if it is to agree to a ceasefire, the prospect of peace still seems elusive.
Crisis meetings are being held in Paris following the crash of Air Algérie flight AH-5017 in northern Mali. All 118 people on board were killed. 51 were French. The plane lost contact 50 minutes after taking off from Burkina Faso to Algiers on Thursday. It's thought bad weather is the most likely reason for the tragedy. Our Europe correspondent Jack Perrock is in Paris.
French President François Hollande announced French troops had found and secured the crash site in the northern Mali desert near the town of Gossi, but that there were no survivors. 51 on board the plane were French nationals. One black box recording device was recovered, however, and it's in the possession of the French. It's hoped it will be able to shed some light on what happened to the aircraft. Mali is a country still torn by civil war, so it's likely France, which had 1,700 troops on the ground before the crash, will take the lead in the investigation.
The European Union reached a preliminary agreement to pursue stronger economic sanctions against Russia in the wake of the downing of the Malaysian Airlines passenger jet. The EU has come under fire lately for its inability to act decisively with regards to Russia. Here's Iris Spitzer from Berlin.
After spending a day and a half deliberating, the European Union decided to push ahead with sanctions for Moscow, asking the Executive Commission to drop a legal text which ambassadors will review next week. The sanctions could include limiting Russian access to European capital markets and an embargo on arms sales to Moscow. All of the important EU member states have strong economic ties to Russia, making sanctions a difficult and potentially costly decision. However, with the Netherlands calling for sanctions unless Moscow stops arming the separatists in eastern Ukraine, and the world watching Europe closely, the EU is facing renewed pressure on the issue.
Threats of further sanctions come as the U.S. says Russia is set to imminently arm pro-Moscow separatists in the east of Ukraine with powerful rocket launchers. From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. Iran has detained the Washington Post newspaper's correspondent in Tehran, alongside his Iranian wife and two American photojournalists. Iranian officials have confirmed that Jason Rezaian, who holds dual Iranian and American citizenship, was under investigation and has been arrested. Nina Maria Potts has more from Washington.
Iranian judicial officials have confirmed the Washington Post's reports that its Tehran correspondent Jason Rezaian, had been detained and was being questioned. He was arrested alongside his Iranian wife, and both are believed to have been held on Tuesday night. What's not clear is where they were taken to, nor if the authorities had a warrant for their arrest. Iran is deemed to be the world's most hostile country towards the press because of the sheer number of journalists it has detained. It is generally more careful about arresting members of the foreign media, though. The two photojournalists detained along with them are U.S. citizens and have not yet been named.
Despite posting a 23% quarterly increase in revenue compared to last year, e-commerce giant Amazon still failed to turn a profit in the second quarter. This comes in a year where the company has unveiled a range of new services to the public. Here's William Denslow with more.
With the introduction of a smartphone, a set-top box, and an expansion of its grocery delivery service, Amazon has shown ambition, but has struggled to translate this to its bottom line. In Amazon's quarterly earnings report, they posted a net loss of $126 million, compared with a loss of $7 million last year, worse than many analysts were expecting. Investors reacted poorly to the news, with shares in Amazon down around 11% in early morning trading on Friday.
And that's the latest from Feature Story News. Rebecca Foster reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports. Israel has rejected a ceasefire plan put forward by U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry as the bloodshed in Gaza spreads to the West Bank. Israel media reports suggest the deal was rejected by the country's cabinet because it leaned too heavily towards the demands of Hamas. Meanwhile, the Palestinian death toll in the 18-day conflict rose to over 800, the majority of those civilians. Nearly 30 Israelis have also been killed. Ahead of that ceasefire plan rejection, correspondent Krista Case Bryant witnessed protests in the Palestinian city of Ramallah.
Yes, so last night there was what some people have called the largest protest at the Kalandia checkpoint between Ramallah and Jerusalem of the last 10 years. And it was quite significant. It sounds like there were all kinds of different people there. It wasn't just young Palestinian men throwing stones. You know, there are even some people who showed up in wheelchairs and, you know, plenty of women and just people from all different walks of life. From what I understand, the protest was organized by a few Fatah activists, but it was seen as a real unified front of Palestinian people against what Israel is doing in Gaza, and one sign of that was that nobody was carrying flags of any of the Palestinian factions, including Hamas. So the only flags there were Palestinian flags. And it follows a speech that President Abbas gave earlier this week where he departed from his normal tone of moderation and called on praised the resistance in Gaza. And some people say, well, that was just him trying to keep his credibility because it's hard for him to look useful right now when he keeps talking about nonviolence and the need to sit down with Israel for negotiations and everything when Hamas is seen by some as doing the only thing that Israel knows or responds to, which is force. So, but some of the protesters I talked to in Ramallah today were saying that the fact that Abbas gave that speech made them feel more empowered to get out in the street because they said, you know, from day one we've supported what's going on. You know, we wanted to express solidarity with the people in Gaza, but we were afraid that the Palestinian security forces, which coordinate with Israel, will crack down on us. I think it will become a lot clearer in the next few days whether this is an outburst of anger over what's going on in Gaza or if it's really going to have the momentum to turn into a full-fledged intifada.
And meanwhile, in Gaza, that Palestinian death toll has now risen to over 800, and the majority of those civilians and nearly 30 Israelis have also been killed. I heard a relief organization director yesterday describe this as a war on children. I thought that was quite an apt phrase, considering what had happened at that UN shelter just the day before.
There's definitely a perception that children are being targeted in greater numbers than in the previous conflicts. I haven't actually compared the statistics, but, you know, while there's some debate about how can you really determine who's a civilian and who's not a civilian because Hamas tries to hide themselves as part of the civilian population, you know, I don't think anybody can argue that kids are Hamas fighters. So That certainly is a really, really sad aspect of this, and one that Hamas is definitely playing up to try to maximize its support, and that's definitely resonating with Palestinians in the West Bank.
Krista Case Bryant in Israel for the Christian Science Monitor. And we'll return to the Gaza conflict in FSN Spotlight later in the show. This is FSN Reports. There are no survivors in the crash of an Air Algérie passenger jet in Mali. The tragic news delivered by French President François Hollande, who also confirmed that one of the plane's black boxes has been found. Flight 5017 was carrying 118 people when it disappeared from radar on Thursday. An investigation into the cause is underway, with some officials already suggesting bad weather was to blame. Our correspondent Jack Parrock is in the French capital.
Overnight, there was very confused reports coming out. Clearly, not much was known. The crash happened in the northern Mali desert, which is relatively inaccessible. But the French president came out today and confirmed the worst fears of the family and friends, that indeed everybody on the plane, AH-5017, had died.
Il n'y a, hélas...
Unfortunately, there are no survivors. I share in the family's pain, who are going through a terrible time. They will be received tomorrow in the French Foreign Ministry so that we can give them all the information, which they have the right to, and also the most brotherly of support from the nation.
And how many people are we talking about, and what percentage of those victims were French nationals?
So originally it was 116 thought to have been on the plane, but we're now hearing reports that it's 118. This happened similarly last week in the MH17 crash, when originally we thought it was 295, and then the number rose to 298 because of babies being carried on their mother's laps, etc. Now it's between 51 people were French nationals, and three others had dual French nationality. Clearly, Algeria is a former French colony, and so there's always a high percentage of French nationals on these planes. A number of others from Burkina Faso, and in fact all over the world, were also killed in this crash, and six Spanish people who were the crew and flight staff.
And Jack, what can you tell us about the role of the French troops, the French military, in not just finding and locating the wreckage, but also securing that crash scene, and what investigation will follow?
So as soon as the reports came out of this crash, François Hollande mobilised a number of troops, a few hundred that were based already in Mali as part of an operation called Operation Serval that was launched in 2013 to help aid the conflict in Mali. There's been a civil war going on there for quite some time now. So he sent them immediately to the region, which is near the town of Gossi in northern Mali, and they secured the site pretty quickly. Clearly, that's from a French point of view. They want to ensure that the site is protected and not disrespected by militia and militants, etc., that do operate in that area. It's reported that this crash site, early reports say that the crash site has a 100-kilometre radius. They're finding debris from the plane 100 kilometres away from where it originally crashed. So clearly this is a very wide area that they're protecting, and it's going to take a long time in very difficult terrain to perform an investigation. But the French president did confirm that they'd found one of the black box recorders. These are key in these plane crashes. They record everything that happens in the flight and are incredibly useful for the investigation to find out exactly what happened in this crash.
Jack Parrock in Paris.
They clearly are on a path to assert themselves differently, not just in Eastern Europe, but in Europe in the main, and toward the United States. Now, I don't know where that takes us right now, but if you're asking me, do I think there's been a change in the relationship, I would have to say absolutely.
America's top general, Martin Dempsey, speaking at a security conference in Colorado, where he said Russian President Vladimir Putin had made a conscious decision to escalate the violence in Ukraine with his support for rebel fighters, an accusation Moscow denies. Mr. Dempsey's comments came after the US State Department said it had strong intelligence Russia had launched cross-border attacks on Ukrainian military targets, and that Moscow was planning to furnish the separatists with even more heavy artillery. Meanwhile, European Union members struck a preliminary deal Friday to impose sector-wide sanctions against Russia following the downing of Malaysia Airlines flight MH17 in eastern Ukraine. Tom Barton is our Moscow correspondent.
We've heard from President Vladimir Putin. He's called it a boomerang effect that he thinks will likely be the result of those sanctions. He's used such sort of language and imagery before, saying that they will hurt those giving the sanctions as much as those getting them. And the analysts and officials that support his view have been lining up to echo that. And also some have gone further, one trade minister saying, sanctions? What sanctions? Really a message of scorn coming from the officials' line in Moscow and saying things like, we had it far worse in the Soviet Union with sanctions then, this is nothing. However, if you talk to Russian economists, or for example to former Finance Minister Alexei Kudrin, a very different view emerges, that potentially all of this anti-Western rhetoric and all of this situation with Ukraine that's leading to these sanctions could potentially be very damaging indeed. One particular point that they point out, these Russian analysts and economists, is the potential for Brussels to put sanctions on Russia's banking sector, and that would mean it would be harder for them to get credit in Europe and would stop Europeans buying shares or debt from Russian state banks. These are the Goliaths of the Russian banking world and vital to keeping Russia's economy moving. And potentially, these Russian economists say, that could have very serious consequences indeed.
Vladimir Putin is enjoying an approval rating somewhere in the 80%. So why would he change tack anyway?
Well, yes, exactly. From an outward political viewpoint, it seems that he's sitting pretty with these huge approval ratings. Many Russians absolutely over the moon at what they see and what Russian state television constantly pours out of the television screens and radios, that this is a Russian revival, that Russia is great again and that it's restored some of its old pride. Very martial notes being struck in the public sphere. And, you know, a lot of this feeding into this message of propaganda from the Kremlin, saying things like that and saying that the West is out to get Russia and this is Russia fighting back. On the surface of it, that's true, that many people do support Putin. But there are also many others. Many of the intellectuals and creative types that Russia really needs in its economy have been leaving Russia, with emigration five times now what it was in the 2 years before Vladimir Putin started his third term as president.
Let me move you towards the US. And today we've been reading about America's top general. That's General Martin Dempsey, who's been speaking today and has been saying that Russia's military is described them as a reluctant participant between the Ukrainian government troops and pro-Russian separatists, but that there is strong US intelligence of Russia's role in this civil war.
Yes, absolutely. There has been mutual claims of shelling across the border, that there has been Ukrainian claims, first of all, that Russian artillery shelled across the border trying to hit Ukrainian positions. And now we hear from the Russian side exactly the same claim directed at the Ukrainian side as well. This evidence, these claims by the Ukrainian forces, were based on US intelligence, which was also released, which the Kremlin has been quick to round on, saying that it is unsubstantiated. However, there is also the ongoing role and months of accusations and evidence presented by NATO, the US, Kiev and others that Russia is supplying not just small arms, but heavy weapons, tanks, rocket launchers, and even the most controversial of all, possibly this Buk anti-aircraft missile system. And that it is still, even after the downing of flight MH17, supplying heavy weapons to those pro-Russian rebels in the east of Ukraine, which is making a lot of Europeans, especially after MH17, increasingly angry. And a lot of Americans see this as an increasingly dangerous situation.
Tom Barton in the Russian capital. Now, finally, tonight, it's FSN Spotlight. And with that, here's Simon Marks.
Today on FSN Spotlight, we return to the conflict in Gaza at the end of a second full week of fighting between Hamas and Israel. Despite a flurry of diplomatic activity in the region, there has been no sign of peace in the offing. Khaled Mashal, the Hamas leader, said this week that any truce must be tied to an Israeli agreement to end its economic blockade of Gaza. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu vowed to continue not only the blockade, but his ground offensive against Hamas and the hundreds of Palestinians who have been killed in its crossfire. Here at FSN this week, rhetorical battle was joined by Professor Noura Erekat, a Palestinian human rights attorney from Georgetown University, and Daniel Arbel, the former deputy chief of mission at the Israeli embassy in Washington. They spoke to Namo Abdullah, Washington correspondent for Rudaw, a 24-hour news channel in Iraqi Kurdistan. He tapes his program every week at FSN's Washington studios. Daniel Arbel kicked things off.
As rockets were showered on Israel, Israel had the right, recognized by the international community, to self-defense. I cannot see how Dr. Erekat sees Israel as an occupier while Israel is not on the ground in Gaza. Israel left Gaza in 2005. Vowing never to return. Israel did not want to go back to Gaza. It was dragged into this by Hamas. Now, if we talk about international law, firing rockets over the border is a breach of international law. Every single rocket which is fired over the border is a breach of international law.
But should that response be invading a country, another land that's not yours?
Absolutely. So the response should have been a self-defense, conducting aerial strikes to eliminate the launching sites, the rocket facilities, which were endangering the Israeli population. Mm-hmm. What happens is that Israel conducted for 10 days surgical strikes on these targets. Mm-hmm. And during those 10 days, Israel accepted an offer for a ceasefire by the Egyptian government. Israel accepted, Hamas rejected.
But Hamas says that ceasefire, they had even not been negotiated about that ceasefire.
Well, I don't know.
And it had only met the Israelis' conditions, none of Hamas's.
I don't know what Hamas. I understand that Hamas was.
And you know, the Egyptian government is against Hamas firmly because Hamas links with the Muslim Brotherhood.
Hamas was approached by the Egyptian government. Hamas received the offer of the Egyptian government. It wasn't imposed on Hamas. Hamas had every ability to respond, to make amendments. It just rejected. The ceasefire totally.
No, that's not true. Hamas did not even see. Mm-hmm. They found out about the ceasefire agreement negotiated by Egypt and Israel through media, so they were not even consulted, so they never saw it. And then they responded with 10 points on which they would agree to a 10-year ceasefire, specifically a lifting of the siege, extending the nautical miles available to fishermen in order to fish, opening up the airport, and creating all conditions that affirm life and allow the Palestinian civilians in Gaza to continue to live. So let's be clear. If these weren't surgical strikes in the 10 days, how can, if this is the one, Israel is the 11th most powerful military in the world. It has precise weapons technology, and yet it targeted more than 12 homes with families still inside. That's hardly a surgical strike. Now let me just then ask the other question. We're constantly, I disagree that in international law, I think Israel should defend itself, but it has other means to defend itself besides this military force that it's using, which it's not legitimate. Nobody ever asks, do Palestinians have the right to defend themselves? How do Palestinians, a stateless population without a military force and absolutely no international protection, defend themselves against military occupation, against a debilitating siege? This siege, by 2020, says the World Health Organization, will make the Gaza Strip unlivable. That means the Palestinians will be unable to survive because of lack of access to water, electricity, of fuel. So what we're saying is, we're going to stop this rocket fire, but allow Palestinians to just slowly die?
You know, what's
about
amazing
What
is amazing here is that during this conflict, Israel has been consistently supplying Gaza with electricity, with water, allowing humanitarian assistance.
That's not true either.
Continuously.
That's absolutely not true.
Do you know any other country in the world that during a war would actually assist the enemy with humanitarian provisions? I mean, this is ridiculous.
It's absolutely not a country. It's a people under occupation. Israel controls
They're not under occupation. Israel's not there. Israel's not there.
Destroyed its water resources, which will be completely destroyed by 2016 and irreparable by 2020. I think that it's very insulting to put forward that Israel is providing fuel and water when it's actually targeting them and has struck the plants.
Israel is targeting Hamas. I have to repeat that. And there are surgical strikes that were conducted.
And what happened? Inside their homes
and
are
Israel,
Hamas.
Israel has actually warned the citizens of Gaza to evacuate dangerous areas, which it plans to strike.
Few people doubt that Israel's biggest enemy in Palestine is Hamas. Okay. But there's so much. There's also so much discussion about the proportionality of the Israeli response. So why has there been so many more civilian casualties than Hamas members? If it's surgical. If Israel is actually aiming to target Hamas,
you've hit the hammer on the nail. Because what happens is that Hamas has circled itself, has situated itself within residential areas. Mm-hmm. Hamas is operating from schools, from homes. Hamas rockets were found in an UNRWA school. Hamas is forcing the innocent civilians of Gaza to surround them, and by that,
it's
acting as human
them.
Shields.
That's the key point that you're saying, it's forcing them.
Hamas spokesman, Az-Zahari, Az-Zahari, advocated live on TV for civilians in Gaza to become human shields.
Yes, and
so that's what happens when Israel surgically strikes a target where you have civilians there. Unfortunately, innocent civilians are hurt in the crossfire.
Professor Arakat, why would the Palestinians accept to be used as a human shield, as Israel says, or as
anyone who accepts the discourse that Palestinians accept to be human shields absolutely does not believe that Palestinians are human, do not love their children, do not love their lives, and do not value their lives in the same way as everybody else on earth. Yeah. This is a dehumanizing discourse, and we should reject it vehemently. Hamas should be condemned for calling on Palestinians to be human shields. That does not mean that they have been human shields. Israel made the same argument in its war in Lebanon in 2006, in fact, in its war in Lebanon in 1982, in its war in Gaza in 2008 and 9, and its war in Gaza in 2012. In all of those instances, the Human Rights Report, from the Goldstone Report to Human Rights Watch to Amnesty International to Israeli organizations like Physicians for Human Rights Israel, as well as Breaking the Silence, a group of former Israeli soldiers, have all said that Hamas and Hezbollah, in this case, because I mentioned Lebanon, have not used their civilians as human shields. And to the contrary, the only evidence of systematic use of Palestinians as human shields has been Israeli use of those civilians. We need to actually scrutinize this discourse, reject what is propaganda and amounts to the dehumanization of a population.
Professor Noura Erekat ending that discussion about the crisis in Gaza with Daniel Arbel, former deputy chief of mission at the Israeli embassy here. The discussion was part of Inside America. It's a weekly TV show produced at FSN and hosted by correspondent Namo Abdullah of the Kurdish news network Rudaw. You can find it online at Rudaw, that's RUDAW.net. With FSN Spotlight, I'm Simon Marks.
And that's the Friday edition of FSN Reports. If you'd like to get in touch with us, you can email us reports@featurestory.com and follow us on Twitter. We're there at Feature Story. But for now, I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington alongside Rebecca Foster with The Bulletin. For everyone with FSN everywhere, have a great weekend. Goodbye.